Okay, sorry, I had to run off because my battery was over for this thing. Before I start, one thing, every one of you who are registered should talk to me about your final project. I know you put up the write-ups already, but you should, during the office hours, and if the office hours don't work, make a separate appointment, and you should make sure that you talk to me. Okay? Some of you already have done, and you're fine. And if everything is fine, I'll just say everything is fine. If not, we will basically talk about what more, how the project should be so that it will make sense. Okay? I started by essentially reading and trying to put comments on the wiki, but I think it's easier. Now that you already written down, you come and talk to me during the afterwards. Okay? That's the. Okay. So, yes. Whether you're right or wrong. Okay. We could look at some of them. I mean, I don't know if anybody else looked at it, or I could. Let's see. I saw some of the answers. Let's see. Yeah, no, let me wait until next class, okay? The only. You have to log in, otherwise you can't edit. Because we are getting Viagra sales advertisement with pictures apparently. So, we essentially made sure that only people who have accounts can actually log in. And so if you need to edit, you need to log in. Okay? So I know that there are some people who answered, but let me wait to see if other people think about it and then we can talk next time. Okay? What else did I put? Review. Reviews are basically for me to make sure that you read. Okay? That's the thing. And you are all supposed to read each other's reviews. Okay? So that's the thing. And then I will look at them in the end when I have to decide whether or not you participated. Okay? And remember that adding the reviews the day before the semester is over is not going to help you because it does keep track of the dates and which you put stuff in. And so, you know, I can tell whether in fact you reviewed on time or not. Yeah, so I think at least one of the very first one there was should you or do you or do you not have to give numbers, I mean utility numbers for lotteries also over and above utility numbers for outcomes? That was the first question in the thinking cap. Okay, because the question was, since we noticed that the real utility of the expected monetary value of a lottery could be lower than, could be higher than the lottery itself, right? Given that, does that mean we have to give utility numbers for each lottery separately? That was the question. And of course, only two people answered, so did anybody else have any? Because imagine what I'm asking. So first, you should know the answer has to be something, because if you have to give numbers for each lottery, how many numbers do you need to give? Infinite number of numbers, right? Right, so you better hope that the answer is no. You know, it better be a resounding no, because otherwise utility theory is out the window. Okay, the idea is that you only need to give numbers for the outcomes, the utility numbers for the outcomes. And in fact, the whole point of expected utility theory says that if you do give utility for outcome one and outcome two, and there is a lottery which says P outcome one and one minus P outcome two, then it's basically P times U of O1 plus one minus P times U of O2 is the outcome, is the utility of this lottery. That's the whole point. Okay. Now, of course, why is there a confusion? Why is is this in consistent with the fact that we said, for example, utility of the expected monetary value of a lottery can be greater than or equal to, in fact, sometimes mostly greater, utility of the lottery itself. So, yeah. So, in fact, actually, we can write this down. Utility of the expected monetary value of, let's say this is lottery L1, of L1 is greater than or equal to utility of the lottery L1. Okay, and the idea there basically is that you are thinking in terms of money here. If you had thought in terms of utilities, then essentially it will be equal. Okay, and so the way the utility changes with respect to money is the question that we were discussing there. But for the utilities itself, if you give the outcome utilities, then you don't need any more utilities. That has large enough number already. Okay, so that was that first question. I think one of you at least sort of said that. One of the two people who said that did say that. Okay. Okay. So going back, last class we basically talked about the fact that we can represent the utility function utility as total orders. In which case you can talk in terms of value functions, and the value functions can have structure under, you know, if you have independence assumptions that hold, then value functions can essentially be additively independent. If there are absolute independent assumptions that hold between attributes, then value functions can be written in independent fashion. Okay, if they don't, then there is a generalized additive independence, which basically says that you can always write this in terms of utility over a set of value functions over a set of factors. Okay, whenever you have a factor, let's say if they're all Boolean, then if you to provide a value function for a factor of size k, that means k attributes are listed there, then you will need 2 power k numbers. Right? Okay, so the advantage is that if in fact the factors are small size, if they are singletons, then that's the lowest you will ever need. Okay, that would be just 2n, okay, where n is the number of attributes. So we said that generalized additive independence is a completely general way of representing the value function, where essentially if there is independence, you can essentially, you will wind up having smaller factors. Okay, if there's no independence, then there would be one factor, one of the factors might be just n sized, in which case then it's like as good as writing all the 2 power m. Okay, now however, you have to realize that when you have GAI, and in fact, and we also pointed out that GAI can actually have, you can think of GAI as having sort of a graphical structure, and if you think of GAI as having a graphical structure, it would essentially, you can make the variables, the attributes as vertices, and if they take part in a common factor, there's an edge between them, and then if you consider the cliques over those, okay, those correspond to factors. Okay, in fact, there is this sort of these things in operations research, this has been called cost networks. These things have been called cost networks. Normally, the question, of course, then is, notice that the factors don't have to be disjoint at all, okay? So, for example, I can have, you know, u of x1, x2 can be u of x1 plus u of x1, x2, okay? So, in other words, what we are saying is that I can actually, I'm basically taking the value here of, these are in terms of value functions. What this basically means is that here, this factor is sort of, when you wind up having the, let me give you an example. So, the idea is that you can think of the addition, if you are repeating an attribute, in another factor, then you are essentially talking about a marginal value that you would have to add because of that. Okay, so just this is an example. I mean, GAI has been used by different people in using value functions. This was actually Jay's work, Jay Benton's work, in the context of planning, in the context of deterministic planning, where suppose instead of just normal deterministic planning, you have a bunch of actions with costs and a bunch of goals, all of which you have to satisfy. Okay, a slightly harder version of planning would be you still have actions with costs, but goals have utilities, different goals have different utilities, and they are independent. So that means if you get G1, you get 5 points, if you get G2, you get 4 points, if you get G3, you get 9 points, and so on. And your interest is assume that the costs and utilities are in the same exact currency. Okay, so then your interest is to find a plan that has the highest cumulative utility minus cumulative cost. Right? That's basically one way you can generalize the deterministic, classical deterministic planning, where you no longer have to achieve all the goals. You want to achieve those goals whose achievement would not cost more than they are worth. Right? For example, if a goal can be achieved, and when it's achieved, you'll get 2 points. Okay, but then to achieve it, you will lose 100 points because you need, 100 actions or like 3 actions which cost cumulatively 100. Then it's too much. Okay, so what you are doing in the context of if you have goals with utilities, then essentially this is what's called partial satisfaction planning, closer to Markov decision process kind of an idea, where in fact, what you're doing is looking for a plan which has sort of the optimal net benefit, where net benefit is the total utility you achieved minus the total cost you incurred. Okay. One nice thing, of course, in the partial satisfaction planning is normal deterministic planning, you look for any plan, just find a plan. Because if you have a large number of goals, even finding a plan that satisfies all the goals is hard enough. And you never had the luxury of saying, oh, I don't feel like doing it. Okay, you have to achieve all the goals. That's when you are called a plan. So if any plan that achieves all the goals, just finding one of them is hard enough. So mostly in planning, people haven't focused as much on optimal plans. Okay. However, if you actually have this scenario where goals have utilities and you are trying to just achieve as many goals as you can, and you don't care about optimality, then there is a huge backdoor, because doing nothing is an actual plan. If you do nothing, then you have zero cost, zero utility. And in fact, you can do worse than zero net benefit, right? By achieving, for example, this is sort of reminds me of negative markings on SAT and, ACT and all these exams, where by answering a question, you can reduce your score. If you're not sure, you wound up answering the question, the answering the question actually reduces your score. Furthermore, in fact, that's just in terms of marks, but if you think in terms of your own effort you spent, if you take any of the exams I ever give, they're normally way longer than the time you have. Okay, I'm not trying to make you scared or anything, but that's just a fact. Okay, and so if they're longer than the time you have, and then you have a problem that you keep working on, and you didn't complete it, okay, then essentially you got worse than zero utility, zero net benefit. You got negative net benefit. Actually, when I was a grad student at Maryland, there was this legendary professor called Lavin Kanal, who was in pattern recognition. The guy, by the time I got there, he was sort of, he's already a legend, and, he used to kind of take it easy, but very smart. And so he would set the exams, and he would once in a while during the class he'll fall asleep and he'll wake up and ask a very tough question. And then he'll also once set a comprehensive exam qualifier, and after about 3/4 of the exam was done, he set one of the questions. After about 3/4 of the exam was over, he came and said, oh, by the way, that question 2, it has no answers. Don't worry about it. So for all those people who spent their time in the first 2 hours trying to do the question 2, they're sunk. Because there is no answer to it. Okay, it's an open question, it turns out. So again, the point is that net benefit can actually be negative sometimes, because you didn't achieve the goal, but you wound up taking the cost anyway. Right? So But you know, if you don't do anything in this kind of a scenario, the plan would have zero utility, I mean zero net benefit, and that's a trivial plan. You want to do better than that. Okay, so that's why it becomes an optimization problem. And in partial satisfaction problem, planning problems, figuring out which set of goals should you focus on so that you can then achieve the best plan for them becomes a hard question. That's not enough. It turns out that if I have 10 goals, it's not really the case that each goal has a point. You know, this is what 3 points, this is what 7 points, this is what 9 points. You know, sometimes goals have dependent benefits. So for example, you know, the classic case would be if you have like a red shoe, left shoe and a right shoe. You know, if you just get left shoe, it's not worth it. If you just get right shoe, it's not worth it. If you get both of them, you'll get some points. Okay? In general, if you achieve two goals, the utility you get for two goals together could be higher or lower than the utility of the individual goals. Right? If you do that, then it will be utility dependencies. So the planning, in the planning, you now have goals with utility dependencies. But this is surprising from a planning perspective, but in this last couple of classes, we've been talking exactly about scenarios where utilities will have dependencies. Right? For example, if I'm taking a minivan, then I want the manufacturer to be this. If I'm not taking a minivan, then I have a different preference. So preferences and utilities will have dependencies between them. Now the interesting question is when you have that, and that's what Jay's work was, and you know, one of his papers, this was I think 2007 Ichikai paper, and basically there are two challenges that he has to deal with. One is, first of all, how to represent the utility dependencies between the goals. So if you have 10 goals, G1 to G10, then you need to provide me a utility metric telling me easily exactly how much I get for each subset of goals I achieve. In the worst case, if you have 10 goals, I need 2 power 10 numbers. Right? 2 power 10 numbers. That's exactly what we were saying. You know, the full utility function, full value function will need 2 power n numbers. If I assume all goals are independent, then I just need 20 numbers. Okay? And then if it's in between, then I essentially have to represent the value function using some sort of a GAI, you know, generalized additive independence. That's what they want, you know, he went with. So he would represent the value function as a GAI value function. And then having represented it, the question would be first figuring out what is the optimal set of goals that you want to achieve. Okay. Since we are talking about planning in this slide, those of you who remember planning from 471 or from the beginning of this semester, you might remember that even when there were no goals, even when the goals didn't have utilities, in the sense all goals have to be done anyway, goals can have dependencies, right? But those dependencies are based on costs. Okay, I can't be both here and in my office at the same time. Okay, so goals have dependencies based on the cost. So it turns out that in this particular case, if you want me to achieve both these goals, I need infinitely costly plan. Okay, so we are already aware of goal dependencies based on costs, and in fact, much of heuristics, you know, planning graph heuristics, relaxed plan heuristics, etc., try to take into account goal dependencies, goal cost dependencies, in trying to figure out how far you are to achieve them. Now I'm just actually adding an extra set of dependencies between goals. Apart from the cost dependencies, they also have utility dependencies. I don't really care whether it's hard for you to achieve them or easy for you to achieve them. I'll tell you, if you do achieve them, this is the amount I'll pay for it. Okay? And in some sense, both, you will wind up taking both of them into consideration in this kind of work, where you wind up searching for a set of goals whose combined utility is high and combined cost is low. That's what you need to do. Okay? Of course, I'll send you a link to this paper so that you can just, I brought this up because we've been talking about GAI without having any specific application. You know, it can be any application where, you know, you can talk about utility numbers. But here I just wanted to say that there's something, for example, one example which from planning perspective, that basically has to deal with, it connects to what we've been discussing here. You will consider the GAI value function, okay? In this particular case, for example, the way they would represent the utilities here, you know, utility of having a plane at location 3 is 1,000, utility of having a person at location 2 is 1,000, utility of having both together is 10. Now that doesn't make sense, you know. If you look at it that way, you would say, wow, just doing both of them is actually cheaper than doing both of, you know, each one separately. But this is the GAI idea. The idea is doing both together is giving you 10 units of extra utility, marginal utility. So this utility is marginal utility. So if you ever have a particular state, for example, where you know plane is at location 3 and person is at location 4, then you look at the GAI to see what are all the factors that are subsumed by the current assignment. And whichever factor is subsumed, that value you get. You see, because you got this subsumed, you'll get just 1,000. And since this one was at location 4, you didn't get this value, and you also didn't get this value. If you are in a state where it is in location 3 and this is in location 2, you get the 1,000 points for this, 1,000 points for this, and 10 extra points bonus. And this could be a negative bonus. If it is car 1 and car 2, you know, car 1 may be worth by itself 20, you know, maybe 20 happiness units. Car 2 by itself is worth 20 happiness units. You have two cars, then you get minus 5 happiness units because you have two cars. So instead of having 40 happiness units, you will have 35 happiness units. Okay, that's basically the way GAI representation works. It's general enough, okay, to represent anything you want. Okay, that's where we were last time, and the question really is, you know, we are the planning, in this slide, we are the planning guys, we are interested in seeing, okay, if I'm given this information, that's what Jay cared about. Where did these numbers come from? He made them up, or maybe he had decided this is a reasonable approximation to the utilities. Now, in real world, you need these numbers to be given by the somebody, your boss, who says these are the goals you have to achieve. Okay, now the question is, can you expect humans to provide these GAI kind of utility numbers? Or do they feel more comfortable in providing some other kind of preference information? Okay, it's clear that if you have this information, I can use it. But the second part of this is basically arguing that the language for representing preferences has to also take into account not just whether or not it is easy for your program to use it, but whether or not the humans can provide preferences in that language. Okay? Now, so the question, of course, is do people, GAI value functions are not necessarily for lay users. If they were for lay users, I didn't have to show you this slide. Right? Because it's sort of unintuitive to provide marginal utilities. If you're an economist, in fact, economists think all the time in terms of marginal costs and marginal utilities. Okay, it's not particularly out of the ordinary to have this kind of representation. But there are two problems with it. One is there is marginal aspect of it. And the second is where exactly do you get these numbers? People might say, I like having one car more than not having a car at all. I like having two cars more than having one car. Okay, these are the kinds of information they might provide you. They may not be able to give you exact happiness units. So the question is, if in fact we are stuck with humans who are going to give you this information, you may have to take qualitative preference information. So this part today we'll be discussing about how to represent qualitative preference information. And then after that we'll say, if the users want, so for example, people supposedly want to, you know, Intel likes to run Intel assembly language. People apparently want to run, you know, write programs in Python or Lisp, okay? So you could essentially do one of two things. One is you pay them money and say, you shall write programs in C. I'm paying you money, so you have to write programs in C, so they will write programs in C. Or you provide assemblers, whatever higher level language is basically converted back down to the Intel assembly language. Okay, so just because I don't feel like writing a program in assembly language doesn't mean that I need to now provide a highly micro-programmed CPU, which actually directly works with high-level programming language support. In fact, this is not a simple this is not as trivial a point as it might sound. For you guys, it's very obvious that the right way to improve the speed of a language is essentially to write a good compiler and then let Intel do its thing, or Intel or AMD do its thing. But for a while in the middle, the prevailing orthodoxy was that the right way to speed up computation is to do microprogramming. So you provide direct support for higher level language primitives at the machine level, at the CPU level. So in fact, you know, if any of you have heard of Lisp machines, okay, a Lisp machine was essentially a highly microprogrammed CPU which had direct support for Lisp instructions. So you don't need to compile anymore. Okay, but then what happened essentially is, essentially the history is telling us that we are better off, given the way the human society works, we are better off letting some people just work on optimizing their compilers, their machine, and some other people work on writing compilers, so rather than having multiple people making multiple hardware platforms. So we'll more or less do the same thing here. We have to humor the humans, so we shall let them give their preferences in partial orders. We'll talk about how to represent them. We'll talk about how to reason with them. And then in the end, when you are about to do stuff with them, we will convert it. We'll try to convert it to value functions. That's the compilation step. Now, just as in C language, some of supporting, or C or Python or whatever, some of the language support, such as saying, oh, you're not writing properly syntactic program, you may have made a mistake here. Those things can be done at the higher level language itself. And then when you think the program is fine, when you, the computer, think that the program is fine, you convert it down to machine language. Right? So similarly, what we'll do is we'll first talk about how to represent the qualitative preferences, how to reason about some consistency issues at that representation itself, and then talk about how to compile this down to assembly language, which is for us value functions. Okay? So what can you expect? What kind of qualitative statements can we expect? We can expect comparison between pairs of complete alternatives, like I prefer this car to that car, but that's, people can say that. It's a pretty useless kind of useful information, because you need to ask too many questions, but people can tell you, oh, I like this overall than this. Sometimes actually they have no clue how to split that down any further. Actually, this is the other interesting thing. Once you have humans in the loop, you're now talking about partial order information. There is this other related issue that until you show them the outcome, they don't know which one. Okay, so this is exactly why you need to actually show them how the outcome would look like. So imagine you're going to a plastic surgeon, right? And you know, you don't like your nose, you don't like your hair, you don't like all sorts of things, and you know, you want to know when you are plugging in, especially given all these, you know, fun people with crazy looks after plastic surgery, you would like to know how you might look after the plastic surgery. They can't just tell you this is $10, this is $25, which one do you want, right? So they make up some way of how you would look by showing your face. And of course, that could be wrong, but you know, then based on that, you would then plunk for it. And you didn't even know until you did that, oh, actually I look good with, you know, my nose kind of little different than the way it is currently. Okay, so you have only preferences over the full entities. You don't necessarily have preferences over attributes. We from the CS point of view would like to believe people have preferences over, you know, attributes. Okay, but it's hard actually for people to have it. So these are easy for people to say, oh, I like this overall car and this overall car. Okay, sometimes they'll also provide you information about certain alternatives are not good. So for example, I prefer a car that's similar to this one, but without the sunroof. They could say that. And similarly, so basically, this is more like what the user, you know, this is, as you go down here, this is what CS people would like, you know, humans to do. But this is definitely what humans do. You know, at the best, you could hope that humans' qualitative preferences could be said, could be written as, in a minivan, I prefer automatic transmission to manual transmission. Okay, so that means minivan and automatic is preferred to minivan and manual transmission. Okay, now, I would argue that this is useful. The closer down here, the better it is for the reasoning system who is trying to satisfy your preferences. Okay? But more likely this is what you would say. Except this would be too many numbers and you are likely to only just say, oh, I like this versus this. But then now you have a different requirement, different scenario, and exactly what should I show you? That would be the most preferred alternative for you. Okay, so we will focus on this. We'll assume that generally the advantage of this representation is that if in fact we do believe that a state has n Boolean variables to represent it, then complete state preferences can be still written in this form. Okay, I like this total conjunction more than this total conjunction. Right? It's an n conjunction. Okay? Here this is anything less than n conjunction, that means it's actually more general preference. Okay? So we will hope that this is the kind of preferences that people have, but at least it's a partial ordering. It's not a number. Okay? Why is it a partial ordering? Just because this is an order doesn't mean it's a partial ordering. The only thing we are saying is people just give you some of their preferences, not all of them. And you will never necessarily have a total ordering over the entire state space. And so you still have to deal with what you currently do have. Okay, so what you are likely to have is, suppose, I'll go back from this slide again, but suppose these are all the outcomes. A totally ordered preference would just put T1 is better than T2 is better than T3 is better than T9. Okay, but what you are more likely to get from what the user is telling you is, T1 is preferred to T6, T2 is preferred to T6, but then, for example, some things are incomparable. Let's say, which are what incomparable? So T3 and T8 are incomparable. That's a partial order. Okay? So when you have a partial order, you at least don't give dominated alternatives. That's all you are supposed to do. Okay? But this is the full partial order, and you would represent this partial order more compactly, hopefully, using these kinds of preference relations that people will give you. Okay, so this preference relation will correspond to some induced partial order over the full outcomes. Okay, so the question is, so here are the kind of examples. So SUV is at least as good as a minivan. So if the type attribute is equal to SUV, then I prefer it at least as much as type attribute equal to minivan. And then similarly, if type attribute is minivan and transmission is automatic, then I prefer it more than type attribute is minivan and transmission is manual. Okay. Now the question is, so this is a reasonable thing. The question, of course, is as soon as I have preferences like this, how do I interpret them? How do I interpret the preferences? Okay. So for example, I can say one interpretation is X type equal to SUV is preferred compared to X type minivan. If I just tell you that somebody likes SUVs more than minivans, how do you interpret that? Does that mean that here is a totally dented up and highly badly reviewed SUV, and here is a Consumer Reports top standing minivan? Do you believe that they will still like SUV more than the minivan? That's one way. That's basically total preference. That means every possible SUV is preferred more than every possible minivan. Yes? No, actually the interesting thing is if I have this information, I can complete it in at least two different ways. One way is to assume that all SUVs are preferred more than all minivans. The other assumption is to say that everything else being equal, SUVs are preferred to minivan. And in economics, everything else being equal is a big deal. And that's what they do. You know, that everything else being equal, housing market will keep going up. Unfortunately, everything is never equal. Okay, but the point is that everything else being equal, the Latin term for this ceteris paribus. Okay, so you can provide two semantics two semantics for preference statements. One semantics is totalitarian. That means you set this preference, so I will assume that your preference will hold for any alternative which is a SUV to any alternative which is a minivan. And that's like the most, that basically assumes that you completely know what you're talking about, and if you really had any qualifications over your preference, you would have said so. Okay? The other one is a much more conservative. So this is much more liberal interpretation of the preference. This is much more conservative interpretation of the preference. It says, if every other attribute has the same value, I have two entities, okay, where every other attribute in those two entities have the same values, except the attributes over which you express preference, and they satisfy your preference, then I would say the preference is satisfied by the entity. So in the case of SUVs, you would say if I have an SUV which is red and it's $20,000 costly, okay, and suppose there are only three things that matter, and then I have a minivan which is also red and which is also $20,000 costly, then I will agree that this SUV is better than this minivan. Now, obviously, neither of these, I mean, this one has a problem too. This is being very conservative. I just don't want to jump to any conclusion other than what you said. Okay, but if you do it this way, at least you won't overload preferences that the user never expressed. This way, users might say, look, you should have filled in blanks, but at least they won't get mad at you. Here, you obviously are actually overloading preferences that they may not have expressed. Okay, so there is a large, this long discussion on this in the paper, right? But there is a good reason why it is to be discussed, because essentially there is a question: when I give a preference like this, what exactly do I mean? Okay, so ceteris paribus is the representation, the interpretation most work in this area takes. Okay, and the ceteris paribus stands for CP. And so when you're talking about CP networks, they are ceteris paribus preference networks. Okay? And so that means they interpret the preferences with the ceteris paribus semantics. Okay? All things else, all else being equal semantics. And in, when you say this, you understand that it's not that this is obviously right, this is obviously wrong. There's a trade-off here. And we chose this because this is conservative. It might require the user, at best the user will say, look, you should have known by now, you know, what I meant. Okay. Whereas here, you essentially, without asking, so when in doubt, you are likely to ask the user here. Whereas in this, you just decide for the user. Okay. And that's why we go with the conservative one. So then you have models, you know, there was a picture like this previously, and the model for that in the value function was the value function, the language, I'm sorry, model was the total order, and the language was value function, either with additive independence or GAI. Now you have a model is a partial order, not a total order, and the language essentially is a set of statements of preferences over, in this particular case, what they're looking at is sets of statements of preference over single attributes. Now, however, if you're only talking about single attributes, then there is an issue, because here actually we are talking about preferences over two attributes. If your language wants to allow preferences over single attributes, then you have to provide a context. Okay, so what CP networks basically do is they will start, just like, you know, use the Bayes network analogy. They will start with, let's say, category on which you have unconditional preference. And then you have a preference over exterior color based on the category. Then you have a preference over interior color which is based on the exterior color. Okay, in this can be seen as a Bayes network. In fact, in this case, it's linear, you know, it's a line graph, but really it's just a diagram. You know, it can be, you know, you could have, for example, something else that depends on category alone, and then something else that depends on category as well as some other attribute. So you could have condition based on multiple parents. Okay, so individual at individual nodes in the CP network, all you need to do is, given the valuation for the parent, what is my preference on this single attribute? You can think of this as CPTs. Forgive the pun, because here CPTs don't mean ceteris paribus tables, but conditional probability tables is what you had in Bayes networks. Okay? Conditional probability tables basically said, given my parents taking certain values, what's the probability that I'll take this value? What's the probability that they'll take at this other value?
He actually also says conditional preference tables. He puts the P as preference.
Yeah. So these are like CPTs, conditional preference tables, except, you know, in the Bayes networks you have conditional probability tables, you have CPTs, conditional preference tables. Okay? So that's so far so good. It's very nice that there is this connection between Bayes networks and CPTs. Okay? And this will provide you a way of representing. So for example, you have a bunch of preference expressions. Here is your outcome space. You only have three attributes, and so essentially, and they're Boolean attributes, it turns out. They only have two values each. And so there are eight outcomes total. Okay? And the user provided the following preferences over them. That would put, if you apply them to the outcome space, it will provide a partial order over the outcomes using the CP, ceteris paribus semantics. You have to, you know, check this out. Okay, and if you write them as a CP net, it looks like this, and the CP net in essence has the same preference order. So if you want your Bayes network semantics, right, this is the joint distribution. Okay, and you're providing a compact representation for joint distribution. CP networks provide a compact representation for joint, you know, value function. In this case, value function really is a partial order over the outcomes. Okay, and then now of course the question is, where are the independence assumptions? Like for example, Bayes networks, one big deal is independences, right? Of course, in the GAI as well as in GAI and additive independence, we talked a lot about independence. So where is the independence here? The independence here essentially is that external color is independent of everything given category. Okay, that's a stronger independence assumption than Bayes networks have. Of course, first of all, it's an independence over preferences. It's not a probabilistic independence. Okay, this preference independence here is stronger. Well, it's hard to compare apples and oranges, but you know, if you kind of try to say what would be the case in the Bayes networks, in Bayes networks, a node is independent of its ancestors given its parents. And it is independent of everybody else given only the Markov blanket. Because if you give the child, for example, the child can have, a descendant can have an impact on this node. Okay, so if you are making those kinds of connections, then obviously the CPNet independence assertions for preferences are sort of more stronger than Bayes network independence assertions for probabilities. Okay, but you don't need to make them because they're really apples and oranges. Okay, okay. So that's the CPNets, and why is CPNets useful? Again, think of my analogy. Why is it that? So of course, why should people write in Python? In fact, humans don't even want to write programs in Python. They want to tell their secretaries, this is what I want, and the secretaries should write the program. Right? Okay. And the real question is, why is Python more useful for the secretaries than, you know, C++ or C++ or some other assembly language? Okay. The idea here is that, so even if the humans don't necessarily want to write, I mean, all we said until now is humans might want to provide preference statements of this kind. As far as they're concerned, they could care less whether you use them this way or you use them this way. Right? The boss wants to tell you what she wants you to do. And you could just write an assembly language program, or you could write a Python and compile it into assembly language. She couldn't care less. So why would you want to write in Python? Is the sort of question we are asking here. Why would I want to write it in CPNet? Because certain questions about whether or not the preferences statements that are provided are consistent can be answered easily given this graphical representation. Yes.
But maybe more.
Well, it's more than that. So basically, these are the kinds of questions that you can ask. Okay. Does S convey an ordering? Does the current CPNet convey an ordering over, you know, outcomes? Okay. Then what's the other one? So find a given an outcome, find all outcomes such that those outcomes are not preferred over O. Okay. And then finally, comparison, which is essentially saying, given two outcomes O and O dash, does the current ordering imply that O is better than O dash? These are the kinds of questions that CP networks can answer. Okay. Again, in fact, there is, if we had time, we should have read actually an entire tutorial just on CP networks. Okay, because that tells you, that will give you the knowledge of CP networks at the level you have knowledge of Bayes network. But I am comfortable enough in telling you where CP networks are, and I can send you a link to the CP network, the main paper. Suffice it to say that currently CP networks are very hot. Okay, so this year at EGCAD, there were two prizes that were given. One was 5-year best paper award from JAIR. JAIR is like one of the top journals in AI, and they basically let the paper be published and then look at who cared about this paper. Okay, and then tell you after 5 years which was the one which had the most impact, most number of citations, etc. That prize went to the original CP Networks paper. It's only 5 years back. Okay, so the original CP Networks paper, which talks about, you know, the representation of CP networks and reasoning over them, that got the Boutillier et al. Paper, that got the best 5-year, you know, high impact paper award. And then, as if that wasn't enough, they also gave give the best paper award for the conference, which is sort of forward looking and can be completely wrong. Okay, so in fact, in any conference, I mean, in some database conferences, for example, they provide a best paper award currently, and then also 10-year best paper award. That is, after 10 years, which paper from this year was considered the most important? If you take the intersection of those sets, they are almost empty. Right, because we are completely bad at judging what ideas will survive. Okay, so if you have a chance, try to get the 10-year best paper award. But you may or may not be alive by then. But, you know, 10-year best paper award means actually people use your idea. Best paper award this year means some bozos think you have a better chance at winning than some other paper. Okay, what's interesting is in EGCAI this year, the best paper in EGCAI also was given to a conference paper which talked about complexity of, you know, certain subclasses of CP networks. That's as good a statement as anybody can make about hotness of an idea, right, in a general conference. So I will send you at least the CP network paper link. I mean, you can also find it because, in fact, the text, the paper refers to it, Boutillier and Braffman and Carmel, I think, Domschlag. That's just, what's interesting is in this tutorial, CPNets are just a small part because they're talking about overall how to represent and reason with preferences. But one particular representation for partially ordered preferences is CPNet. Okay?
The conveyor ordering is based on cyclical, right?
Yes.
The cyclical content.
Yeah. Okay? These two slides really won't give you everything about CPNets. All this is doing is, in the bigger picture of preference research, where do CPNets sit? Okay, I mean, if you just came into the, you know, the area and you found that you look for preferences in each guy this year, all of them will be about CPNets. So you would think that's the only thing that you need to know. But really, you also need to know where they sit in the overall picture. That's what this tutorial is trying to tell you. And that's what a textbook level, you know, treatment is supposed to tell you. Okay.
How about the answer? How about the answer to the first question? Can we answer that in you said something about NP completion.
What?
NP hard.
Yeah, so no, many of the questions on CPNets can be quite hard. Okay. And that's why, again, they talk about special classes of CPNet. This should not be surprising to you because if you take a Bayes net, many of the questions on Bayes net are also hard. By the way, this is one reason why I do want to do in the list of topics that I had listed, there was one topic which is about tree width and graph width. And it's a very kind of dry topic, but it's sort of below the hood for many of these ideas. Okay, if you have base networks and you want to understand their complexity, you need to understand the idea of induced width. Okay, if you want to understand some of the results in CP networks, again you need to understand the induced width. If you want to understand how certain CSP algorithms are faster than certain others, again you need to understand the notion of induced width. Okay, so we will. I'm still hoping that I'll get that done in this class. That's why I listed that. Many times, what happens is this complexity depends on things like induced width. Okay. Okay. Any other questions on this stuff? If not, then I will just do these two finish quickly because I want to complete this class preference discussion. Next class onwards, since I'm here, since the subject came up, next class onwards, my idea is to start doing temporal probabilistic models. Okay, this is on the way eventually to relational probabilistic models. And temporal probabilistic models can be thought of as templated probabilistic models. And one of the things I'm hoping to do starting now is go slowly from propositional to relational. Remember, we've been happy, we kind of talked a lot about the fact that we used to do mostly atomic stuff, then we can do propositional stuff, propositional representation. Base networks are propositional representation. CP networks are propositional representation. Okay, we want to go slowly towards relational representation. Okay, and in fact, the one thing from 471 that we didn't do, in 471 we did base networks, which are propositional representation. Okay, temporal base networks wind up talking essentially about this templated view, because you will wind up providing how the network evolves from time 0 to time 1, and the assumption is from time 1 to time 2 you copy the network again, time 2 to time 3 you copy the network again. Okay, so in a way it's a templated representation, and understanding some of the issues there will also help you understand the relational probabilistic network. Plus, temporal probabilistic networks are very useful because if you want to reason about actions, one of the questions that we haven't really talked too much about is what are good representations for actions which are stochastic. We just provided one representation, that was the PPDDL representation. Okay, but it turns out that if you understand dynamic Bayes networks, then there is something called 2TBN, which is 2-time-slice Bayes network, which is a great way to represent an action. It tells you the state variables before the action, state variables after the action, and how they are connected.
Didn't we have that graph plan part where we had that action representation with the conditions and the...
Yes, but we did not talk about stochastic. Okay. So anyway, so that's what I'll be doing next class, and I'll send you the chapter from the latest book, the third edition on temporal probabilistic networks. Okay, and then we'll start talking about some of them. You already know things like some of you will already know things like hidden Markov models and Kalman filters. They all fall under the same dynamic Bayes networks category. But the reason we are going through it is essentially we're going slowly away from propositional towards relational. Okay. So that's for next class. And today I want to complete two more things, preference compilation. So if this is what hopefully humans are more interested in giving, okay, remember that really humans are more interested in giving this, you may want to represent it this way. Okay, but then this value functions are essentially what are easier to handle. Remember, ultimately, everybody who wants to deal with preference functions, whether it's a planner, whether it's a diagnosis system, whether something else, a recommendation system, has to be able to deal with this. So planning guys will deal with all the planning oriented problems such as cost interactions, and on top of that have to deal with utility interactions. Right? Recommendation guys will deal with generating the space of recommendations to begin with, plus generating the subspace of that which is actually consistent with the preferences. Okay, So whatever we are saying here will basically, it is useful to talk about what is the simplest representation from the computational point of view, and is there a way of compiling the other one into the simpler one. Okay, and so preference compilation essentially talks about, given partial order information, can you compile it down to value function. Okay, it's not a huge deal, but essentially when I provide a partial order function, partial order preferences, I didn't even give you a number. A value function will be numbers and it will be cardinal, so that means A, it will tell you how much better each outcome is compared to every other outcome. And furthermore, if I give you a value function, it's a total order. So I'm doing two things, you know, even though I'm starting with partial order, non-quantitative preferences, when I compile it down to value function, I become total order, quantitative preferences. Obviously, I'm making up stuff, right? Users didn't tell me this is what they want. But the hope is that as long as the new value function that I came up with is consistent with every expressed preference of the user, they shouldn't care. Do you understand what I'm saying? So I told you I care, I like A better than B, I like C better than D. Okay? So A better than B, C better than D. So then I can just say, well, I will assume that A is 5 for you, B is 3 for you, C is 2, and D is 1. If I do this, then obviously you suddenly now, even though you never said so, you actually like B better than C. Right? And then you also like A better than D. You only actually gave me these, and I am consistent with them. Okay, so normally when you compile, unlike, this is not true, I mean again, every analogy breaks, you know, that's why these are analogies. So the compilation analogy breaks pretty awfully here. You know, if I take a Python program and if I say, oh, there are like 10,000 compilations, which completely different semantics for this Python program, then you would be a little worried, right? And here on the other hand, I'm saying if you have given me partial preferences, then I can compile it down into a bunch of value functions. And all I require is that the value function is consistent with the expressed preferences. Okay, now what's more interesting, of course, is what can I actually, how do I come up with these numbers? Well, it turns out the general idea is if I say U of A, I mean, I like A better than B, then I would like to basically say V of A is greater than V of B. Okay, and similarly, I like, you know, C better than B, V of C is greater than V of D. And then I might decide to put some arbitrary scaling. So value functions are, for all V, all value functions are between 0 and 1. The value function is, you know, bounded by 0 and 1. And then get me VA, VB, VC, VD values such that all constraints are satisfied. This is a constraint satisfaction problem with linear constraint, with inequality constraint. Okay? In essence, if you remember the linear programming, if some of you know the linear programming background, then essentially these constraints will set up a polytope, and any point in that polytope is a feasible solution. There isn't much of an optimization function here, really. Okay, normally linear programming also has an optimization function, and so you are looking for the point in the polytope where the optimization objective function has the highest value. And for that, there is theory which says that even though polytope is full of points, the optimum can only exist at the corners of the polytopes. Here, all I want is just find that the constraints are actually consistent, and just like a CSP, find me a solution. Which is what CSP is. There was a raised hand somewhere. Yes, sir.
How do you assume the preferences
between
like, B and C and
D in that example? We did not assume. All I'm saying is these are my constraints. Okay? So suppose I said the following thing, okay? Suppose I said the following thing. You have to do four tasks, T1, T2, T3, T4. Okay? You are a factory scheduler, factory foreman or forewoman. And I said, I definitely want T1 to be done before T2. I also definitely want T3 to be done before T4. Now you make your schedule. You don't have to ask me. If this is the only thing I tell you, you don't need to come and ask me, what about T2 and T3? I didn't tell you, so I don't care. Okay? So a schedule, you will make a schedule for the factory which is consistent with all the expressed constraints. Scheduling is a constraint satisfaction problem. And here I'm finding a schedule for the value function. So now in the factory, the exact numbers, ultimately the task has to be started. This has to be started at 9 a.m. This has to be started, let's say, at 11 a.m. This has to be started at 3 p.m. This has to be started at 4:30 p.m. That's a schedule. There are many such schedules that would be consistent with this. And you don't complain that your users aren't more picky. You are happy that they are not more picky. Because if they are not more picky, then you can schedule, many, many schedules will be consistent. Right? That's the same thing here. Now, when you schedule, it may well be that T1 gets done before T3 or after T3. But I shouldn't care because I didn't tell you that I have a preference over them. Okay? So that's what a compilation will do. Now, one of the interesting questions, of course, is later on I come and say, oh, by the way, I do have a preference over T2 and T3, then that's an extra constraint. So this would be incremental constraint satisfaction, where as the additional preferences are made, you essentially need to change the value function because it's inconsistent with it. They don't talk about it, but there are approaches for CSP where you keep track of the set of solutions, and then essentially when a new constraint is added, you are able to filter some of the solutions out. But you know, here they just talk about setting it up. Okay. Now the question, of course, is that how exactly am I going to get this value function thing? So in fact, one problem that I did here, which you did not question me, is value functions are not supposed to be over A, B, C, D. I mean, unlike tasks here, so if A and B and C and D are the attributes somehow, so in a way I can say A being true is preferred more than B being true, and C being true is preferred more than D being true. That's what I'm saying. Okay? Now, a value function, on the other hand, should actually tell me the valuations for 2 power 4 are 16 different states. Right? Do I like A true, B true, C false, D false, and then A true, B false, C true, D false? How do these compare? I need to give a number for this, a number for this. Really, even though I said these are the kinds of constraints you will put, what you really need to do is these constraints should be in terms of states. And there are exponential number of states in terms of valuation, value functions, in terms of attributes. Okay? So yes, it will still be a constraint satisfaction problem, except you are likely to have exponential number of constraints. And you know, you might say, well, if I say I prefer A to B, how many constraints am I going to write? You will write all the CP constraints, all the ceteris paribus constraints. So if A is true and everything else is false, and C and D are false, that's preferred to B is true and C and D are false. So that's the ceteris paribus point. Okay, so you would wind up, each preference becomes multiple constraints, and you know, all these constraints have to be satisfied. Okay, now it turns out that obviously that he tries to do two different ways of this compilation. One is try to see if there is a structure to the preference function that you are trying to compile down. If in fact originally you are starting from this CP network and this is where you are partial ordering information is coming from, then it's more than the partial order that is present there. You also have conditional independence assertion. Okay. Furthermore, in fact, a CP network like this essentially says that you can write VXYZ as VX of X plus VY of YX plus VZ of ZY. This is how GAI function would be written. So that basic idea is Y is independent of everything given X, and Z is independent of everything given Y. X is its own thing. So I need to tell you first how much I like X being true, X being false. Then I need to tell you how much I like, y being true given x is true, and y being true given x is false, y being false given x is false, and blah, blah, blah. So all four of those. Then I need to tell you the same thing for z and y. This is exactly how CPTs in Bayes networks get multiplied to give the joint distribution. Here, the CPTs, the conditional preference tables in the CP networks get added to give the full network and give the full preference value function, right? Okay. So if I know that this is where I'm starting from, in a compilation I would know this, right? Because presumably I talk to the user enough that in fact I have decided that there are some independent assertions, and in fact this is the best CP network to represent. Okay. The reason I said in compilation you are likely to know this is that the preference compilation and not the gamble sentinel function, the preference compilation and the learning part have a lot in common. Okay, because in both cases you are making inductive leaps. In compiling, you are not just sticking to what they said. You are talking about any valuation value function that's consistent with the constraints that are specified. The same thing in learning. Okay, so there's a lot more in common between those two. One aspect, of course, is in learning, you know, in if it is compilation step, probably you can assume that apart from just the partial preferences, you also have been given some independence assertions because you talked to the user and you figured out. Okay, and so if I have this structure, then essentially I'll only need to compute these numbers. So my CSP previously would have been 8-valued CSP. There were 8 variables for which I need numerical values. Now it would be not particularly much better, but it is like 4 plus 4 plus 2. Is it worse? yeah, it's worse, but you know, in this case it's actually worse, but they are marginal numbers. What? Will be much lower. Okay. So then the basically you have Vx, x, there are 2 variables, Vy, yx, there are 4 variables, Vz, zy, there are 4 variables, and you need to get those numbers. And so your CP, your constraints, the linear inequalities would be in terms of those variables. Okay, this is only showing that if you have this kind of references, you may be able to find this kind of evaluation function. And how you do it is you set up this kind of linear program, right? And then find any solution for that linear program. That would be a value function. Okay? That was the point they're making. Okay? And the bigger the question would then be the size of the linear program. Here, basically, because you use the structure, the size of the linear program could be smaller. I mean, size of the program that you're trying to solve is smaller. Okay. The other issue, of course, is what if I don't know the independence assertions? All I know is the partial preferences. I don't know the independence assertions. Then I'm more or less stuck with having to assume that I have to write the entire state information. Okay. What they talk about, and I actually won't go into too much detail, unless I do kernel based learning in this class, I can't really make sense of it here, but for those of you who know kernel based learning, this should be kind of making a lot of sense. What they're saying is, well, what you wanted was, you know, you seem to have a thing for linear or additive value functions. Now, if the independence assertions don't hold, then clearly, in fact, if you had your choice, you even hate this. What you really want is fully additive utility function. Imagine if I told you that the CP network is, there is no link here, there is no link here. So then X and Y and Z are 3 independent attributes of the outcome. Right? Then I just need 6 numbers and I'll have the smallest program to solve. Right? I mean, CSPs will be larger based on the number of variables. I mean, would be costlier based on the number of variables. So if I only have, you know, fully additively independent, then I have the smallest number of variables that I need to solve for, right? So the question is, Here already, because I have factors, I'm increasing. Okay, but if I don't know the structure, then I don't know which factors to pick. And if I pick every factor, then I do worse than 2 power n. Already in this case, I did worse than 2 power n. And we are hoping that for the large cases, you know, it would be smaller. But if, in fact, you consider every possible factor and see which independences hold as part of trying to decide what value function holds, then you're doing hard more than what is really needed, not less. Okay? So the other idea is to say, look for only additive features. Okay, so here is another analogy. So suppose you are here, and if I tell you it is completely additive, that's like saying you're learning a neural network and it's a perceptron. And you know it's easier to learn. If I tell you that, well, there are some dependencies between them, then that's like saying, well, I'll learn a neural network that's multi-layer network. Because when there are dependencies, there is no linear separation in the classifier space. So one way of separating the classes is to learn nonlinear separators. So you go for multi-level neural networks. Another way of solving that, and in fact, how many of you have taken machine learning course and haven't heard about multi-level neural networks anymore? Yeah, there is no multi-level neural networks being talked about. They're coming back in vogue, but again, in the trailing edge. But currently, it's all, they're gone. You know, nobody talks about them. Why? Because another way of, if all you cared about is linear separability, then just increase the number of features. And there would be some feature space where these things are linearly separable. We talked about this some classes back. In particular, if you have n data points, you know, in the worst case, you will need only n dimensions. And they will be linearly separable then. The hope is there a smaller number of dimensions than n where they are linearly separable? Okay? To do this, you essentially increase the number of features, not just the attributes, but combined attributes. Okay? So in fact, the idea that these guys talk about is if you have x1, x2 as the attributes, then they will not only consider x1, x2, but x1, x2 together, x1, x2 being two together, x1 true, x2 false, x2 true, x1 false, and so on. So it increases the number of features exponentially. And then each point now is each data point, each preference ordering also has a representation in this higher dimensional space. Furthermore, you can argue that any preference function whatsoever would be additively independent in the higher dimensional space. Because the worst you will ever need to do is provide value function for every state separately. If you find yourself giving more than 2 power n numbers, then you're sunk. You're doing worse than is needed. I mean, you're thinking supposedly you can get fewer numbers, but then you're learning more than 2 power n numbers. Then you did something wrong somewhere, right?
Why is it 4 to the
n? I don't know. I'm not sure. I think it's just the question of I have to get back to you on that. Okay. I think it's just a question of the number of dimensions.
Mapping feature to feature space. So you're saying over there that the feature space is space in 4 n?
I have to look at that. Okay. So I think it may well be just for this example. I have to look at this. But ultimately the issue is, since you are looking at subsets of features, then it will be linearly separable. Okay. Now of course, then the question is, yeah, that's true, but why is this any better than my zeroth idea, which is to say that every preference corresponds to some number of constraints over utilities of complete states, right? This way, actually, I have more features than the number of complete states. Do you guys see this? Because complete states are only complete interpretations. But now I also consider partial interpretations, just the conjunctions of size 2, size 1, size 3, size 4, size 5, all the way to size n. It's true that size n will dominate, but I at least doubled it. Right? Why should I do it? Why is that any better than setting up constraints just in terms of valuation of the states? It normally isn't, but for the kernel trick. Okay? And that's, for whatever I said, should make those people who did kernel-based learning methods say, yeah, that makes sense. They may actually not know what they're saying, but at least they'll feel, yeah, at least we heard about it somewhere else. And those of you who didn't, you don't know what I just said. Okay. It essentially says that you don't actually have to blow up the space. If you change the distance metric, then that is equivalent, distance metric between points in the base space, then that is equivalent to kind of going to a higher dimensional space. Okay, and under certain technical conditions, it turns out that the new distance metric, so by doing this, in essence, you don't do the intermediate step of first blowing it up and bringing it down. You just do one step, which is equivalent to blowing it up and seeing which part of the space matters. But of course, it's not as clean as that. In fact, I am not a big fan of kernel-based methods, but that's neither here nor there. If I were teaching you kernel-based methods, I'd also told you what's below the rug. They're very powerful methods, but there's always something that's below the rug. Okay, and in particular, there are some issues there too. But if you know kernel-based methods, what all they're saying is you can use them, and that's how you would not do any worse, and you can sometimes do much better. Okay, I guess I have to stop here. The learning aspect, in essence, what they'll wind up saying is some of the same things, but they would say if you are talking about Bayesian approaches, then they'll assume that they have to have some idea of the value function structure. Okay, and if you have multiple value functions possible, Bayesian learning requires a prior over those value functions. Okay. If you have a prior over the value functions, then every time a user expresses a preference, that's an extra training example, you change the prior to the posterior. And in true Bayesian learning, you never actually pick a single example, single hypothesis at all. You just start with all hypotheses with a prior. In the end, you have all hypotheses with a posterior. And then you weight, you do the classification. If it's classification, you do classification by weighted average. Okay, so you could do it that way for learning for preference functions. The other alternative is, what if you don't have the prior available? And if you don't have the prior available, they suggest two methods. One is try to minimize the regret. The other is ask questions to the user. Of course, that's the part of the paper that's quite important for those people who are trying to learn preferences. I might spend a few minutes next class, but it's also the more advanced part. There's very little, coherent piece of work. There are lots of people learning preferences, but without having too much theory for it. So you should read that part, but there's a lot in common between that part and compilation, because there is still an inductive leap in both cases. Okay? So I will stop here. By default, next class we'll be doing temporal probabilistic models. If there are specific questions on the learning part, I'll say a few things on the preference functions.